In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I've got an extra special Coolest Conversations going on, as I'll be speaking with the man himself, Stevie Van Zandt, Little Steven. And we'll be talking about Smokey Robinson. And why? Well, because of our recent Coolest Song in the World, a version of The Tears of a Clown, which features Smokey being backed by Steven with the Disciples of Soul. The original song was a hit for the Miracles back in 1970, and this live version was recorded at last year's American Music Honors Program, where Steven also gave the induction speech for Smokey. We'll hear a tad of the tune now, followed by my chat with Steven on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Ladies and gentlemen, Smokey and Steven.
Let's go!
Really up.
Yes. Yeah, baby. Yeah.
Mighty Manfred here for your coolest conversations, and it don't get no cooler in the underground garage than when you got the man at hand. Ladies and gentlemen, in satellite radio listening land, I am joined today by our great patron of rock and roll, Mr. Stevie Van Zandt, better known to all as Little Steven. Our coolest song in the world this week features him paired with a legendary Smokey Robinson, backed by the Disciples of Soul, doing a version of the Miracles hit, The Tears of the Clown. It was recorded live last year at the American Music Honors. Hey, Stevie, how are you?
Manny, how are you? I'm good.
I'm doing pretty good. I wore my purple jacket for you. And before the camera started rolling, I was thinking, man, he better be wearing purple.
I got purple somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, you got purple right there on top of your head.
Oh, okay. Yeah, good, good.
Well, so first off, I want to know what you gave this induction speech, this Smokey Robinson American Music Honors, is somehow tied to Bruce Springsteen. What was this event that you guys performed at?
Oh, they started a new thing a few years ago as part of the Bruce Springsteen Archives. I forget the full name of it, but it's Bruce Archives and American Music, something like that.
Yeah, Bruce. I think the whole thing is Bruce Springsteen Archives and Center for American Music.
Yeah, there you go. So they started this American Music Awards, and they give out, I think it's four every year.
And it was like Smokey Robinson for this year, along with Emmylou Harris, John Fogerty, Joe Ely, and like Tom Morello.
Yeah, so it's like four every year, and this past year was Smokey Robinson, and
you gave the induction speech.
Yes, I was honored to do so.
So, I mean, you obviously must have a lot of love for Smokey Robinson. Tell me about how Smokey plays into yours or your...
Well, I mean, we owe Smokey a lot because he was a very integral part of the early Motown record label. He had the first million-selling Motown hit with Shop Around, 1960 or so, and became vice president of Motown and was a major songwriter, the first major songwriter. Mary Wells and the Temptations and others before Holland, Dozier Holland came in and the other cats, you know. So he was such an important part of that label. And that label, you know, is just the soul music, you know, the ultimate soul music label. I mean, what a roster of artists. Is ridiculous.
Well, let me ask you about this. There's a thing I want to ask you about here. So, you know, John, you're talking about Smokey and his songwriting, his great talents. I just, you know, people should remember that before John Lennon was in his Dylan phase, trying to write Dylan songs, now he was trying to write Smokey Robinson-type songs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like with yourself, how did he, Robinson, specifically influence you? Did you have a Smokey period or some sort of period where you were like, man, I got to really dig into this stuff. This is, you know, I want to try and... Yeah. Use these things, these ideas. What can I do to build on it?
Yeah, I've never left my Smokey period. To tell you the truth. Lennon, they actually covered. You Really Got a Hold on Me. I think it's on their second album. The two or three songs, All I've Got to Do and things like that, were definitely Smokey Robinson influence for me. You know, I played the fool with the Jukes. Forever on my first solo album. There's got to be a half a dozen at least of Smokey Robinson influence. Not only vocally, you know, and melody wise, but also just the songs themselves, you know, the music too. So he's been an influence on me. And like I said in the induction speech, you know, it's nice when you have a favorite artist, a favorite writer, a favorite arranger, a favorite producer, you know, and they're all the same guy, you know. It's convenient, you know. So he's been extraordinarily important to me.
So you played with him at the event, but you guys must have crossed paths before. Have you?
No. I'd never met him. So that was a wonderful.
So how did it come together that you guys were playing? I mean, who set that up?
I think the idea of the archives, you know, the performance event is for people to interact with each other, you know, people, you know, play each other's songs and basically interact. And, you know, it was suggested. I think Bruce might have suggested, I do something with Smokey and we did Tears of a Clown, which, believe it or not, I think was only number one record. Certainly, it's only number one record with the Miracles anyway.
Yeah, and that was not until like 1970, you know, the recording.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. It really is hard to believe. I mean, after, you know, all of those amazing Going to a Go-Go and all the rest. It was really kind of late. And at first, they didn't want to release it. Barry Gordy didn't want to release it. It was kind of a controversial song. I don't know why. I mean, it sounds like a number one hit to me immediately. But, you know, he had that interesting orchestration, you know. It was like a circus atmosphere, which is what Smokey was intending.
Yes. My understanding is that Hank Cosby and Stevie Wonder kind of came up with some of the initial music and they brought it to Smokey Robinson to see what he wanted to do with it.
Yeah. So he had the Pagliacci, you know, the clown type idea, and you know, so he kind of orchestrated it to sound like a circus song, and you know, it's just the coolest thing ever. I don't know why they thought this is, you know, somehow not a single, but it took him like a year. It was on the shelf for like a year or something.
Well, so my understanding is that the Motown office in the UK or London was responsible for. They were looking for Miracle stuff. There was demands, and they went ahead and they put it out, and when it went to number one immediately in the UK, like Barry Gordy, he could hear those cash registers ringing from all across the Atlantic, right? Because he has very sensitive ears, and he heard those bells ringing, and he knew, and so were you able to talk to him or at all? Did you get any kind of moments, or was he just up on stage?
I just said, man, you know, let's make a new record together, okay? I got half a dozen songs ready to go that I've, you know, done on my own records and the Jukes records, you know. I mean, literally, I got half an album right now, you know. I'd love to hear Smokey sing, you know, I Played the Fool or Forever or Soul Fire or, you know, so many of mine are Smokey influenced, so... I think he would feel very comfortable with those songs.
I think this sounds very doable. This is well within reach. He's going to be touring, I believe, beginning tomorrow. He kicks off this Legacy of Love tour in Mississippi. And then that runs through April.
And I would urge everybody to go see him because he's still great, as you can hear on the single that we did. He's just terrific still and such a legend. You know, I'm not sure how much longer he's going to be touring.
Right. So. Well, I think actually he and Dion are the same age. I think they're both 86.
And they both act like they're 25. So it's amazing to me. You know, it's something changed with you know, the concept of chronological time. Okay. I mean, I didn't know anybody over 65 growing up. All right. I mean, you know, people were in wheelchairs in senior citizens' homes in their 60s when I was growing up. And now I got 20 friends that are in their 80s on stage performing. It's something changed. I think it's the rock and roll affected the DNA somehow. That's my theory.
Oh, I'll go with that. I think that's pretty great too. So I'm not sure how much more time we have, but I want us to go out with a tune that you do with. Speaking of greats, you're on stage with Paul McCartney. You did a version of I Saw Her Standing There a couple of years ago. So I want us to play that to go out with, and I want to ask you about him. But first, it's just like you've always got this great respect for, you know, that generation of rockers before you. And, of course, they're very influential, and you've been able to work with these guys like, was it Bonds, Gary U.S. Bonds. But you really cut your teeth, I think, like with the Dovells back around the late 60s, early 70s. How did you get... There's some story about you were working construction and then you went back into music. How did you hook up with the Dovells?
Yeah, it's a long story. I talk about it in my book in more detail. But basically, I was working construction and playing flag football on the weekend. And I broke my finger playing flag football, you know, dislocated it, still bent. And so I decided to join this local bar band to exercise my finger, you know. And that bar band happened to be the drummer happened to be the cousin of one of the Dovells, and they needed a band. They were going to Vegas, and they needed a backup band. And so I ended up joining that thing as the band leader. You know, it was a lot of fun. I did that whole what they called the oldie circuit in those days. Which you wouldn't have even known existed unless you were actually on the circuit, because, you know, it was obscure hotels. But then you'd also play Madison Square Garden. That's the first time I played the Garden. And you'd play Las Vegas. And that's all I had to hear was Las Vegas, because I was a big gambler as a kid. And I was also a mafia aficionado. So I knew all about, you know, Benny Siegel starting the Flamingo. And it was the Flamingo that we played, so I was particularly thrilled about that, you know. I did that for a year and met all the pioneers, man, all my heroes. That's when I first met Little Richard, Gary Bonds, Lloyd Price, everybody. I mean, the Drifters.
Was that like the Beatles had their days in Hamburg where they're working, you know, do these shows all the time? Was that your Hamburg time?
Kind of, to some extent. It was certainly an educational time. I think the Stone Pony years with the Jukes is probably more like the Hamburg time, you know. But this was before that, you know. So it was like... Still absorbing, you know, that 50s stuff and early 60s stuff, which so important to start with the roots, you know. And I tell everybody that, you know, the new artists, you know, if you can start with the roots, you know, you're going to have a very solid foundation when you start, you know, finding your own identity. And that's just a great way to start. And it was very important to me and to meet those guys, you know. It's a shame because they were all very unhappy.
Why?
At being put out to pasture. You know, the British invasion put them all out of work, which was, you know, ironic. You know, here comes the British invasion, which was introducing those guys' music to us, to my generation. And yet, you know, they put them all out of work. I mean, if you had three hits when the Beatles came, you played those three hits the rest of your life, you know? And... it was a shame because that's the only generation where that happened. Right away with the 60s generation, the audience and the artists grew together. And to this day, I mean, the biggest bands in the 60s was the Beatles and Stones, and they're still the biggest thing 60 years later, you know? It's amazing, really. So that generation just kind of got left out. And that's why I wanted to show my gratitude to them and started putting them on records whenever I could, you know? We put Ronnie Spector and Lee Dorsey on the Jukes' first album and reunited the Drifters and Coasters and Five Satins on the Jukes' second record. And then, you know, we worked with Gary Bonds. I worked with Darlene Love. We worked with Benny King. We worked with Chuck Jackson. You know, just trying to let people know that they were still great because they were literally put out to pasture in their prime. I mean, late 30s, you know, early 40s, and they were just... done, you know. It was a shame.
You know, it's interesting. I was wanted to, you know, the thing I was going to ask you about was that moment of singularity, the rock and roll big bang. You know, that I know what you were doing February the 9th, 1964. You must have been around 13 at the time. And then the question would be, well, how, you know, the next day, how was the world different? And you've pretty much been addressing that, you know, all these guys are kind of put out. But for you personally, I mean, the next day, were you, you know, trying to comb the bangs of your hair down to trying to get more of a mop top or you know?
Well, that would take a little while. that wouldn't happen for another, 3 years. It took that long to grow it out. But the Beatles changed more than just us musicians or wannabe musicians. It changed the whole culture into a band culture. If you went out at night and you know, you either went to the drive-in theater or you went to see a band. you know, or you were in a band. But that's how much that culture changed. I mean, what really brought it home to me was, you know, that was the first epiphany, obviously, you know. But they were so good, Manny. They you know, they just were actually so good. You couldn't really picture doing it, you know. They were so evolved at that point, so sophisticated. You know, the harmony was perfect. The hair was perfect. The suits, the songs. I mean, it was just like beyond, you know, your reach.
You know, what's great to hear you say that is because we're familiar with The Remains, right? The Boston band, The Remains, the 60s legendary band. They got these great songs, and they had this really quick sort of history where they form, they're signed to a record label, they're on Ed Sullivan, and they get to open up for the Beatles, and they do this big North American tour, and these guys should be positioned to, like, really take on the world, and they break up because, and I always thought that this was a lame-ass thing to say, but you've just addressed that, where they said, we broke up because the Beatles were so great. What else could we do? How else could we go on? We play with the greatest band in the world. We can't even fathom being as great as these guys, or doing as great as these guys, or writing as great as these guys.
Well, but for me, and I think for a lot of people, 4 months later, Rolling Stones come. And this made the difference to me, you know, because they weren't as sophisticated. They didn't have much harmony to speak of. They all wore whatever they felt like wearing. They were right off the street. They were really like the first punk band in that sense, and they made it look easier than it was. You know, they made it accessible for us. And so I saw them on that Hollywood Palace show, that famous one, like June or something like that, June of that same year that the Beatles came, just whatever it was, 4 months later. And the next night, my friend invited me to his beach club. You know, in Jersey, beach clubs were a big thing. You know, my family didn't belong to one, but his did. And we went to the beach club, and that night, a group called the Mods were playing. And that was the first live band I'd ever seen. And to me, they were like the Rolling Stones come to life. You know. And they were doing Stone songs, and that really made the electrical connection for me. I was like, "Whoa, you mean you can do that? You know, you can actually do that in a local way, you know? Because England was such a fantasy, you know what I mean? I mean, it was like, you know, and your parents would say to you, you know, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to be a Beatle, you know, and you know, you're going to be a Rolling Stone. And you have to admit to yourself, you know, it's kind of far-fetched, because you have to be English to be a rock star. There was nothing else, you know. The Birds and the rest of that would come a year later, in the summer of 65. But in 64, there was nothing but English rock stars. So, you know, if you weren't English, you know, you didn't have much of a chance of being a rock star. But, you know, I saw it. I saw it in the Mods, man. They were like, you know, I remember, you know, the front man, you know, and man, they were just like the Rolling Stones come to life, man. And that was like, that was it for me. I'm like, oh, man, I can do this. And now they're showing me that it is possible to do this locally, you know. So that was a big moment.
So you're probably 13, going on 14, somewhere in there. And were you already playing guitar?
I just started playing guitar just to hang out with my grandfather, because he was teaching me the song from his village in Calabria. You know, and it's a simple little song, and so he showed me that, and that was all. That was about all I knew until the Beatles hit that February 9th, and then, you know, my interest in guitar was greatly accelerated, you know.
Well, we're going to go out with this tune with you playing with Sir Paul.
One of the great thrills of my life. I mean, you know, Paul had come on our stage with the E Street Band, which was thrilling. And then he invited me and Bruce on stage with his band at the Garden, which was thrilling. But coming on stage with my band, the Disciples of Soul, in this club, the Roundhouse Club in London, you know, that was incredible to me. You know, such a feeling of, you know, a respect from him, the guy, you know, I respect most in the world, you know. It was such a, you know, an affirmation of what I'm doing. You know, it was just one of the highlights of my life, undoubtedly. You know?
Now, you mentioned, like, with Smokey Robinson, you guys hadn't actually prior to that performance and that night. But with Paul, had you guys had, I guess, played before a couple of times?
Yeah. We're getting, you know, pretty friendly. You know, we would have dinner with our wives, you know, and not too often, but every 6 months, once a year, something like that, you know. And it was nice, man, because he's just the greatest guy in the world. And you know, and he immediately said, you know, use it for whatever you want, man. You know, use my performance any way you want to use it. You know, there was no sort of, you know, protecting. I mean, and by the way, you know, we didn't rehearse or anything. He had the balls to come on stage, not knowing what we're going to do, you know. I luckily just quickly arranged. I had heard he was coming to the show right before the sound check ended, and I said really quick, let's do a Little Richard arrangement of I Saw Her Standing There, because I know Paul's a Little Richard fan. I never would have heard a Little Richard if it wasn't for Paul McCartney, you know. It was obvious that was the thing we could do, and so I did a very, very quick arrangement, and I told Eddie, you know, my orchestrator, I said, you know, orchestrate it backstage, because we gotta let the people in. It was raining outside, you know, and I had just flown in from filming the Marty Scorsese movie, you know, the night before. I did a little cameo in the Scorsese movie. So I was just like, it was all very, very harried and, you know, we got to let the people in. And so, you know, we barely rehearsed it ourselves. And then Paul showed up on the encore, you know, just surprised me. And luckily we had prepared that thing. I was glad we did, you know.
Well, all right. We're going to take a lesson into that then. And man, I'm so happy you had a chance to, you know, yak it up with me some. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Good seeing you, man.
All right, well, we're going to give a spin now to I Saw Her Standing There. It's Paul McCartney with Little Steven and the Disciples of Soul here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Yeah.
That was Sir Paul McCartney joining Little Stephen and the Disciples of Soul with a roaring rendition of the Beatles' I Saw Her Standing There. That's part of the Soulfire Live release that got recorded in Camden overseas in the UK back in 2017. This is the Mighty Manfred, and many thanks again to Stevie Van Zandt for joining me on today's Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. And be sure and catch your next Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.